I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
How many shows do you reckon you've done this year?
A lot.
Over 50? Easy?
We've been on tour for the last 4 months.
Well, I've been on tour for 6 weeks, and I'm starting to feel the burn, and it really makes you appreciate the extreme slog and hard work that touring is. I think a lot of people presume that, you know, it's all luxury and fun and games, and when you're actually on the road and you're around it and you see it, especially bands like yourselves, you tour for months on end. How do you mentally as well as physically get through it?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question. I don't think you do. I think you...
You just have to embrace the insanity of it all and just ride the wave.
I think so. I think that's the only answer to give. I don't know. I mean, everyone's different. You know, people do different things. I try to go for a walk every day. Like that kind of
just to get some
like
headspace.
The normality or kind of the balancer, I think, you know, and, you know, that I don't know, for me, you know, other people watch movies or read books. I guess I don't know what other people do. Drink.
Well, there's a lot of that goes on as well, and I think that is the that's the one that takes the real toll, isn't it? Is I feel like you wake up, say, a bit tired or hungover, but then as soon as you play that show and the adrenaline hits, then you're like, fuck it, right now I want some beers, and then it's just repeat.
There's a famous quote about musicians that say it's not the years, it's the miles.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that puts the miles on you.
But you've taken some miles off by shaving the mustache, Joby, so I should just set the scene real quick as well. We're on your tour bus. You're laid down on the floor. I've never done a podcast quite like this before.
It's relaxing.
I actually broke my spine coming up on 5 years ago. It'll be 5 years on December 15th. So I can sympathize with the constant, like, nagging, like it's not agony, but it's just like a constant nagging pain, I find.
Yeah, you know, I was having this conversation with somebody the other day that we think playing guitar is probably the worst ergonomical thing you can do for your body. You know, just running around with like 10 pounds on one side, you know.
Oh, I don't know how Matt does what he does every night, because he takes a fucking beating in that pit every night.
He's insane. It's interesting to watch, I'll tell you that much. I don't know how he does it. I would never do that.
Did you see the guy the other night who had the mouth guard and goggles? That's the funniest fucking thing I've ever seen. He had swimming goggles and a mouth guard in the pit.
He was prepared. He was prepared.
How far does your friendship go back with Matt? Did you go to school together?
No, we... excuse me. I knew his older brother, Jeff. I was probably 19 when I met him, his brother. And
what's the age difference between you and Matt?
5 years.
5 years. Right, wow.
And so we used to, my roommate at the time was friends with Matt's older brother, Jeff, and they used to work at this karaoke bar in Huntington Beach called Mr. K's. We would always go there because they didn't card anybody. So you can, you know, in America, you have to be 21 to drink alcohol. And so we could bring in anybody we wanted.
You know? Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
And Mr. K, because we knew him, it sounds so hilarious now, but they would they had like private rooms you could rent, and so you and your friends could go in there and sing the songs that you wanted to or whatever.
Like proper Japanese karaoke bar style. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, Mr. K every once in a while would throw us a bone, and we get our own room, and like I think they had like soju and I don't know, you know, stuff like that. So Jeff was always trying to get me to go see his brother's band, which was called Brotherhood of Death. And I was in a band called Jack Ruby, who was, you know, the guy that shot one of our presidents. I can't remember who it was. This was a long time ago. And he was like, your band should play together. And I was like, yeah, whatever, man. We're awesome. And we'll see. And so, Matt would come into Mr. K's every once in a while, and I had heard that he was a singer in a band, so Jeff introduced me to him, and I was like, hey man, you want to sing a song? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, let's sing Hot for Teacher by Van Halen. and we did, and I was really impressed about how good of a singer he was. And I went and saw his band at a place that is in Huntington Beach called the Liquid Den. Which still to this day was some of the craziest shows I've ever been to were at that place. The security, we would literally beat people up, and all the shows were just fights.
That day's kind of gone, hasn't it?
Oh yeah. It's over.
Well, it's definitely gone. Long gone.
And, he, let me see. I'm trying to get my timeline right here. I think
taking you way back.
Yeah, I think I went there with our original drummer, Jorma, and because we were looking for a singer, I think we had started writing some wrong songs, just me and him at that point. And so we would go watch all these bands that we heard had cool singers, and I was like, hey, you know, my friend Jeff, yeah, I kind of know this guy, he's got this band, let's go check him out. And so he, it was just the most insane thing I've ever seen in my life. And I was like, man, this guy is awesome. I just really wanted to be in a band with him.
Because of just the voice, or was the whole, like,
well, I
package
think, I think
already
it,
in place?
I think it was...
The charisma and the...
Jorma brought some girls to the concert that were really out of place. And so Matt jumped off the stage and into their table. there was pictures of beer on it. And so it smashed all the glass, and the beer went all over the girls. And it was the coolest thing I've ever seen.
He's hired.
Yeah. And then after he did that, two of his friends took tables and just started smashing them and chairs. And security guard came over and just started beating them up. And it was just like
pandemonium.
And so the crazy thing is the rest of the guys in the band just laid down on stage and refused to play until security stopped beating people up.
Yeah.
It's just insanity, you know?
And then you start writing straight away with Matt, or what happens then?
Yeah, I was like, a friend of ours had a studio that Jorma knew, and we went down and cut three songs that we still play to this day. Heart Attack American, White Tar, and Strobe Life of our first record. And that's when we kind of first heard Matt sing. And
Strobe Life's about his kind of crazy speed whirlwind, right, at that time?
Yeah, you know, drugs were prevalent, you know, as in most youngsters' lives.
Yeah.
And, you know...
You coming up?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, you do stuff as kids that, you know, seems intelligent at the time.
Yeah, And I mean, you're obviously a dad now yourself. I mean, just to jump around real quickly, does that change your outlook on life? Do you become all of a sudden a little bit more responsible and aware of?
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, I mean,
your own mortality and your responsibility as a parent.
All the crap that you hear about being a parent is true. You know, all the stuff, and then all this crap that your parents told you. You know, one day when you're older, you know, all that stuff's true.
Yeah, and you're like, shut up, mom and dad.
Yeah,
that'll never happen.
You don't know what you're talking about. I know everything. Yeah.
And you got two kids, right?
Yeah, my daughter is 11, and my son is 7.
Wow.
Yeah. It's
she's about to hit teens.
Yeah, they're people, you know. And along with that, you know, it's the cycle, you know. I mean, they're both wonderful children, and you know, it's like we have a great relationship, and you know, it's tough to you know, be out here and be away from them, but thank God we have these phones. You know what I mean?
I was saying that the other day. I think there's a lot of negatives, I think, that have come with social media and smartphones and all of that. But the definite obvious, you know, pro is that guys like yourself, when you're on the road for days, weeks, sometimes months on end, you get to see their face.
Totally.
And actually, like, communicate and connect whenever you want.
Absolutely.
And I imagine back in the day, it'd be the case that you'd have to have, like, a stack of coins and you just go to, like, a phone box.
Yeah.
Or you just nick the promoter's phone and hope you can get some free time on that.
I mean, I remember, I think our first, you know, world tour was 3.5 months, in like 16 countries or something like that. And I would literally sneak into the club's office and try and call home, or we would find internet cafes and you know, you got a free like Hotmail email address or something. Try to check in every once in a while. And I could never get the calling cards to work. Some bands were like, oh yeah, find a payphone someplace. And it was funny because when we were doing our first record, we did it with Gilby Clark from Guns N' Roses. And
how was that?
It was killer.
Was he fucking cool? Was he good energy to be around?
Absolutely. He's a wonderful person.
Great stories as well.
Oh, all the stories.
Yeah.
All the stories. That was probably the best part of making the record.
Yeah. Tell us another one, Gilby.
Yeah. But he would always give a shit. He would be like, man, you guys have cell phones now. And I was like, so? And he's like, yeah, you pull up to gigs and they would be canceled. And,
you have no way of finding out. Yeah.
There's no way. And, you know, you had to learn how to read a map, you know?
Yep.
Just all the, you know, it's different. And I'm sure that, you know, bands in the future, you know, I'm sure they won't even have to leave their living room to play shows, you know, like virtual reality will put them in clubs or something, and we'll moan about how we used to have to tour around and actually play.
Back in the good old days, man. Yeah. It happened pretty quick for you guys out the gate, right? There's a lot of like interest straight away. And
yeah, I mean, that was the early days of the internet, you know, and we would put songs online. And at that time, that was like a really... You know, it was like a new technology, you know, having downloadable MP3s on a website.
I guess digital fans as well. That was a new concept.
And a way to reach record labels. And, you know, before, you know, instead of having to send a demo cassette blindly into, you know, which I did in like every band I was in, we would get the addresses off of, you know, records that we liked. And we would send our demo in and, you know, of course, never heard anything. But, and so that way we were able to reach a lot of different people, you know, through that medium, which is now gone.
Yeah.
It's been replaced. So I don't know if ages me or not, you know. Right. We were talking about this the other day. It's like all the different music mediums that we have gone through in my lifetime. Started with cassettes, and that's how I got into music. Was, you know, you had the cassette duplicating tape deck, you know, and I would borrow, you know, an eighth generation copy of, you know, Suicidal Tendencies, Lights, Camera, Revolution, you know, and that's just, it's just, and then from there, you know, CDs completely replaced that, MP, you know, so on and so
forth. It's funny because music piracy in one form or another was probably always there.
Right? Always there.
It was just on a lot smaller scale before the internet.
Dude, you know what was crazy? One of the craziest pirating things I ever heard of or have ever experienced, and some of the best records I own, is from my wife and I's honeymoon, we went down to Jamaica, to Ocho Rios, and if I'm trying to paint the picture there, if you've never been down there, it's bars and clubs are literally sheet metal roofs and like a cooler full of Red Stripe,
yeah,
and the biggest PA you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah.
And what the music that they do down there, it was really interesting. It's basically, it's they call it toasting. It's basically freestyling over all the old Studio One records. And these music piracy down there is these guys would come in, plug into the desk, and burn CDs live while the show happened, and they sell it on the corner the next day. And so we would buy some of these burned CDs, and I don't know who, you know.
There's no track list.
There's nothing. Yeah. And it was like, still to this day, some of the best music I've ever heard, and I have no idea who's ever done it, you know. So you're right on the music piracy thing, and it's, ever since there has been music, it's been pirated in a one way, shape, or form.
Do you feel like, for me, when I was a kid, pre-internet, the element of discovery was half the excitement and enjoyment of music? And I feel like now you can obviously access any song by anyone ever pretty much at the touch of a button, but I feel like because it's all there, a lot of that exploration element has gone, and therefore some of the joy of it has gone. Is that idea of, like, you know, as you say, you get that one album off a friend,
yeah,
and you burn that, and yeah, you just burn that out and listen to that all day, all day, all day.
Well, I think what it's done is it's kind of killed the album, you know.
Yeah.
you just said it, every song at the touch of a button, and
obviously it's the skip generation now.
Exactly.
Skip track, shuffle.
Yep. And just people just don't listen to records anymore, you know. And but yes, like, that's an experience that I'm happy to have had, and as well as I'm sure you are too, is just digging through bins and, you know, discovering labels, and you're like, oh, I like what this label puts out.
Yeah.
I like this kind of music, or these bands, or from, you know, this era, or just, you know, it's something that I hope comes back, because I would listen for hours to all of this music that I would never heard before from these genres and generations that I would get turned on to by, you know, Joe Blow at the record store. It's like, oh, if you know, I'd buy a record and he'd be like, oh, you like this, go check that out.
Yeah.
So, okay. And so,
what were the bands for you then that switched you on, that made you want to be a musician and play rock and roll? Was it always rock and roll in one form?
Yeah. I mean, when I grew up, my parents had a rule that all of us kids had to learn two instruments. And so
I support that.
Yeah.
I wish I'd been pushed to play an instrument from a young age.
Oh, well, the two instruments that I studied were piano and cello, which neither of which I play. And so the music that filled, you know, me as a child was classical music, you know, the big ones, Beethoven, Bach, Rachmaninoff, Mozart. And once I discovered loud, aggressive music, that was it. Like, I was like, it was kind of me rebelling against what I was brought up on, you know. And my parents were listening to classical music in the house too, and my grandparents were listening to classical music as well. And so it was this whole new world. And that's right when tape trading kind of happened. And you could go buy blank tapes for nothing.
Yeah.
And my parents used to get them for me. And then you would borrow these comps and that and all of this stuff. And I got really into skateboarding around that time too. And Thrasher magazine used to put out these compilations called Skate Rock. And there was, I don't know if this is correct, but I think there was 8 volumes of them. They would put out one a year. And a lot of it featured bands that were, you know, skaters, like Steve Caballero's band, The Faction. Like, I got turned onto that band by the Skate Rock comps. And, you know, D.I., D.R.I., J.F.A., you know, all of this stuff. And that, there was something about skateboarding that I identified with faster music. I don't know what it is, but it just makes sense. And I think that all the videos that we would watch, you know, as kids, all the Bone Brigade stuff featured music from these punk bands.
Yeah.
And
that was when skateboarding and punk rock were both very much outsider subcultures, weren't they?
100%.
And they weren't popular, they weren't mainstream, and the likelihood was if you were rolling around the street on a skateboard or with a mohawk, you were probably going to get, you know,
yep,
arrested 100%. Or beaten up. Or
It wasn't cool
yeah.
at all. And it was, but it captured the youth of America, you know, like a certain type of kid, you know,
yeah,
that
yeah,
didn't
yeah.
want to play football, didn't want to, you know, be a jock or whatever. And still to this day, you know, I know we talked about phones earlier, but like I can watch all my favorite skaters from when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Like I follow their lives now, you know, which is hilarious. But they went hand in hand, and there was a lot of bands that would play at skate demos, or bands that would play on ramps, or there would be, like, punk in the early days was a joke, you know, like, all of us skaters, we would go to all these shows, and it was like donation, you would donate cans of food, you know, and they would give them to the homeless, you know, or nothing was ever, no one ever made money.
Well, the idea, I think, before Nirvana, the idea of making a career out of punk rock was inconceivable, wasn't it? And then I 100%. Guess Nirvana changed the whole game. Then, of course, after that, Green Day. And
yeah,
I mean, all of a sudden, it's like, well, you can actually make tons of fucking money from punk rock.
Yeah, there's bands that can do it, you know. And it's still...
X and Fear and the Germs and all those bands, nothing. They were never...
No, and it wasn't... Like, a career was inconceivable. Like,
yeah.
Like, we played music just... You know, we had no aspirations of ever, like, making a record, you know. We would just get together and... You know, like my friend's dad had two acoustic guitars and we kind of figured it out. I mean, this was before the internet, you know, and so, you know, he would show us some chords, you know, and we'd play them till our fingers hurt, you know, and the next day we'd do the same thing and we'd skate, you know, and it was just, I don't know, just what you did, you know.
A golden time to be young, right? Without sounding like the two old
geezers. I think so. I look back on those times and it was... You know, like you said, it was a lot of discovery, you know, like you would, you know, because it was tough. It was tough to find those records, you know, like most record stores didn't carry punk. You know, you had to order it from out of magazines, you know, or from the labels themselves. And like mail order was a big way to get. And I remember every record I bought came with a catalog of all the rest of the records that label would put out. And so, you know, you'd read about the bands and all right, I'd send, you know, my mom would write a check. I'd save up my money and she'd send a check in to SST and I'd get the new Minutemen record, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I spoke to Casey Chaos a lot about that. And he said he was a pen pal with Danzig, with Ian MacKay, with Henry Rollins, with all these guys.
That was like, a big part of the punk
write
scene.
To them and they'd write back.
Exactly. That was a big part of the punk scene. And I remember when I first started playing, like, we would go up to San Francisco, we'd play like a matinee with all these different bands and we'd exchange each other's addresses and we'd write letters to them. And that's the way that the punk community worked back then, you know, and it was like no one else wrote letters, but we did because it's cheap, it's easy, and that's how you knew what was going on. And that's how you would kind of, you know, mailing lists. Like I know it's like people collect email addresses now, I guess, but back then, you know, you would play and people would sign up and they would leave their address and you would send them out flyers or whatever you're doing for that month, the shows, and you'd get it in the mail. You know, there was this one band called EOS, which stood for End of Story. I signed up on their mailing list and every month I would get a list of all the shows and where they were. There's little maps drawn like at this address or at this house and $3 or donation only, you know, and all
of this stuff.
And that's how people did it.
Were there any local bands to your area that were inspiring to you that made you go, well, if they can do it, we can do it?
Yeah. I mean, they were just, but I mean, no one made it, you know, it was just like the fact that four people could do something together was inspiring. I mean, there was bands, EOS, like I mentioned before, there's a band called The Lonely Now. Those were kind of the two big bands that I remember as a, you know, like we're talking 11, 12, you know, that I remember and going and seeing. And they were, and like all these bands would, the only place that they would, it was either VFW halls, houses, or churches for some reason. Like basements of churches would always allow all ages shows and kids to play. It was really bizarre.
Yeah. Little do they know what's going on.
I think churches will do anything to get people to come in them.
Get the youth. Get them in. Get them through the door. So you put out your first album on your own label. Is that right? And was that a conscious choice? Because you had the offer on the table, right? From a major or?
Yes. We had, I mean, you got to realize we had played maybe 10 shows and we had like, don't even remember, like 12 labels that wanted to. It was a joke. I mean, because we used the internet to our advantage and we would send, like, people would contact us like, hey, you know, and I, we would write back in Morse code or something, because I found some website that would change whatever you said into Morse code, and we would just we developed this sort of moniker of this person called the Governor that would just write these cryptic messages, and a friend of ours worked, I think, for Jive Records, and he was like, hey, you know, you guys can, like, I can spin this for you to the whole industry, and just, it'd be hilarious. Let's see what happens. And we're like, dude, okay, cool. So then we're like, all right, well, you know, if you want to meet with us, you got to send us, like, all of these albums. And we would just get fucking records up the ass from these labels, because they didn't care, you know? And I remember this one time, this guy, this steroided out A&R guy was like, send me the rock. I'm like, all right, give me your FedEx number. We filled a FedEx box full of rocks. It was like $150 to send it to him. But yeah, and it was like, at that time, I used to work for a record label, so I kind of understood the pecking order or the ladder to climb. And it was... we had two choices. You know, we could sit there and take a ton of money and our careers would have ended just as fast as it had started.
I guess that's the thing that most bands, as soon as that carrot is dangled in front of them, 9 out of every 10 bands just grab it, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
Without the long-term game in mind.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like, I wanted to play music. Like, that's why I took a job at a record label, because I could be closer to bands. Maybe I could meet somebody and get in a band or something, you know? And so... our manager at the time was like baffled that, you know, and I was like, hey, this is what I want to do. And so because we had recorded our record, we owned it. And so that put all the, you know, cards in our favor. And so we licensed it to a smaller label. And as soon as we did that, then we signed for another record with Island Def Jam. And so we were able to retain the rights of that, and we licensed it all over the world. And we were able to tour on that for about 2.5 years, I think, before we made
went over to the dark side.
Yeah, the Money Pit record.
What was that experience like then? Was it a total leap and a total change and a total shock?
Yeah. It was just...
Who produced that second one?
A guy named Michael Beinhorn, who did like Soundgarden, Super Unknown, like Marilyn Manson's Mechanical Animals, Korn's, you know, Untouchables. Like he actually, you know what the really cool thing about Michael Beinhorn is that he wrote Rocket, the Herbie Hancock song. And I was like, man, that is cool. That's cool. That sealed the deal for me when we were meeting with all, you know, these big money producers or whatever. And so it was great, man. It was an exercise in extravagance, you know. We made a record, I think, like 6 months in the studio, like on the beach in Venice, you know. And we lived down there. We would stay and, you know, surf in the mornings. And some days we didn't feel like working, you know, and just wasting money, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Because it's right at the tail end of when there was money to waste, right?
I think that was the end of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Or the last I remember of it. And, it was just insane. You know, I had never seen anything like that, you know, and we would rent this, all these amps and these drums and these microphones and compressors and had these guys, there was guys coming in and out of the studio to like work on our guitars and, you know, tech the drums and all of these things, you know, that we just, everybody was happy to get paid for it, and we didn't know what was going on. We're like, I don't know, this is what the producer says to do, I guess, you know. And
Ken and Brad in the band at this point?
No. It was just it was Matt, myself, our original bass player James, and our original drummer Jorma. And it was one of the best times of my life, you know, because I'm glad I got to experience that ridiculous lifestyle, you know. And
what were the main lessons you took from it?
Well, I'd never do that again. Well, I you learn to become frugal, I think, you know, and since no one buys records anymore, like that's just gone. And I'm glad I got to experience, you know, what it was like, you know, or what I thought, you know. I was like, oh, I hear all these stories about, you know, Def Leppard working on their record for like a year, and I was like, hey, that just sounds cool to be in the studio. And it's like, we got a lot of work done, you know, and it was, you know, making a record with Michael Beinhorn is, you're going to make the record he wants to make. And, you know, I think it was difficult on Matt because he tracked his vocals for months, you know, and it was, you know, I think we just didn't have that experience really. And it was just like, well, I sang it, why do I have to sing it again and again and again, you know, and trying to get that magical take and things. And, you know, that's what Michael's really good at, you know. And I Matt still to this day says that's like his favorite record he's ever sang on. It's like the best performances he's ever given. So,
'cause he's getting pushed.
Yes, exactly. And that, you know, that's what Michael does. And, you know, and then it was like, you know, we went to some big pro mixer guy named Mike Shipley, who mixes all Mutt Lang stuff. He did all the AC/DC records and all the Def Leppard records. And, you know, I'm just, you know, a wide-eyed kid.
Looking at the records on the walls like, fuck, yeah, we're in good company here.
And, yeah, and right when our record came out, right before our record came out, the president, it basically got shelved. The Island Def Jam switched presidents, and they turned into a pop label, and so all the rock acts went away.
That's such a common story, isn't it? There's so many bands. It's the one guy that's maybe fighting that corner. If he's gone,
yeah,
then that whole
is gone. It was just over, you know. And it's, I don't know. I don't even know if they're around anymore. I'm sure they are, but you know, it's the business has changed. And you know, we've figured out what works for us through, you know, things like that, experiences like that. And, you know, for our second record, after they shelved that one, and it just, I haven't looked at our record sales. I don't think it sold very much. Or according to the amount of money that was put into it.
Yeah, relatively speaking. Yeah.
The label had, they fired our A&R guy. And we had two A&R guys, and so I called them up, and I was like, listen, our last record, you guys spent, I think we spent $275,000 on it. And I was like, for half of that, I can buy a studio and make records forever, and this is what you guys need to do for bands. And yourselves, you know, invest in, you know, and so they did, and so we bought a recording studio and gear and all this stuff, and then we got dropped.
And did you get to keep it?
Yeah,
you did. That's fucking wicked.
And so we,
so you still use that? Is that the one that you made with the record with Carl?
Yeah.
So it's still getting good use.
Yeah. Still clicking along. We sold it and we moved it to a different place because none of us live around where it is anymore. So all the gear got moved to a new studio space. So.
But that was the initial investment that you've kind of been living off ever since. Yeah. That's great, man. And that's punk rock, isn't it? If you're doing it yourself.
Yeah, I mean,
that's kind of
the goal. I was always really interested in recording. So it's like, and to be able to, you know, get all that stuff. And, you know, I mean, God, we were there every day, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night, just recording and writing and recording bands. And, you know, there was an apartment above, you know, so bands would come in and they would live up above the studio, and then we'd come down. And I mean, it was just a really fun time, you know, in our lives. And a lot of music came out of there. We recorded our Bronx 3 album there, and our Bronx 4 record there. A bunch of the mariachi stuff was done there. It was a really great time. You know.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I love the Mariachi Project so much.
Oh, right on.
I love watching you go back and do Bronx after having seen the Mariachi show so many times, because they're such polar opposite ends of the spectrum on one hand, but then the spirit and the soul, I think, is the same.
I think so. You know, to me, someone asked me, they're like, how the fuck do you guys do that and this?
I mean,
and
what was the initial idea? Where did it come from?
I think looking back on it, because that was around 2005, 2006, I think, when we were started to do it, even though it didn't come out till later. It's like I think there was a real gentrification happening in LA. Like there was a lot of, you know, white people moving over to East LA, which is a predominantly Hispanic neighborhoods. And we were just immersed kind of in it, you know what I mean? It's like, I heard just as much of that coming out of people's cars and houses as I did, you know, K-Rock or whatever radio station people listen to. And so, like, to me, it coexisted in the world that we lived in. So I probably, to people that don't...
Do you think a lot of people thought it was a novelty initially?
Yeah, and just because most people's, you know, exposure, most white people's exposure to that is, like, the Three Amigos, the movie, where it was kind of a joke, the mariachi suits. And, like, it wasn't to me, but I think people view that as a novelty in general. But, you know, those two worlds coexisted, you know, and it just, to me, it sounds like California.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
Yeah, yeah, that melting pot.
It is, you know, and, like, there was, like, the punk scene, and then there's that scene, and, like, everybody was kind of in both, you know, there wasn't really a separation, you know.
Yeah.
It was fun times.
And did you ever foresee it becoming the full-time thing that it is? Because obviously now it's pretty much the case that you will say do a Bronx record and tour that, and then you'll go do a mariachi record and tour that. Did you ever think when you started out writing that kind of music that it would be all these years later?
No, I mean, and it's like, you know, just it, like an all-encompassing answer to that would be like, I'm still surprised that we're playing music. Like none of this was ever... You know, even from when I was a kid, it was, you just do things because you want to. And it's like, man, I really want to play this music. Like, let's learn these instruments. And, oh, man, this guy plays trumpet. Cool. You know, this guy can play that. All right, let's do that. You know, it's the same sort of kind of, you know, and that, again, in itself was kind of the same discovering, like, a new style of music, you know.
Yeah,
and
we
would just listen to these records and play all this stuff and just go down these wormholes of... you know, Latin music, and it was really, really cool. You know, it was like discovering punk all over again, you know.
Is it a very different vibe when you are writing, or is it kind of the same?
You know, it's kind of the same. I think that's why it doesn't really... I mean, there's more instruments, obviously, in that band than there is in the Bronx, but it's still kind of the same thing. It starts with a simple chord progression and idea, and, well, let's, you know, if the lyrics kind of work, then let's add this in and then put that on and then mix this or change that. You know, it's like, that's just, every band writes things in a completely different way. And that's kind of the way we've found that works for us, you know. I think one of the most fascinating things about bands is watching, like their creative process, you know, because
absolutely.
The way we do it is completely opposite to, you know, bands that I've worked with in the past, and it's always so interesting to me, like why in the fuck would you ever do it that way? But the, you know, they say the same thing about me, you know, I'm like, why would you ever do that way?
What I really like about watching both projects live is you can see that Matt is really in awe of all of you guys as players, and that's a really just like a sincere, quite joyful experience as a viewer to kind of experience that through him, his respect and admiration of his bandmates.
That goes both ways, because I mean, how many singers do you know that can croon and scream?
Yeah.
You know, like, he's pretty impressive.
Yeah,
you know, I could never do that.
Did that band take you into a whole different world as well, like in terms of the TV shows that it would get you on? Or?
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, that was, you know, that, I mean, we grew up watching, like, Jay Leno and David Letterman, mm-hmm. you know, and it was, like, the fact that we got to play those late night circuit or whatever you call it was, and meet them, it was just, like, just hilarious. It was like...
Bronx aren't ever going on those shows, are they?
Yeah, doubt it, you know, but it was really, it's, like, you know, one of the coolest things is we, you know, when we played David Letterman, you know, all of our families flew out to New York City to watch it. You know, my dad told me, he was like, Never in a million years would I think my son would be play the same theater on the same TV show as I saw the Beatles, because that David Letterman took over the, and you know, there's pictures of, it's really cool, like in the,
well, the Ed Sullivan Theater, yeah, was it? Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like there's pictures like in the dressing room of the Beatles, you know, like on the wall, and like we're in the same dressing room, and I was like, wow, this is just surreal. And you know, touring wise, like that's when we, you know, we were on big arena tours, like with the Foo Fighters, with the Killers, you know, Dave Matthews Band, like all of these ridiculous rock bands, you know, we got to play with and meet with, and you know, we became, you know, I still have good, you know, relationships with a lot of those people. And And it was, but to see how like big arena rock works was pretty eye opening. You know,
yeah.
It's
another peek into a different world, isn't it?
100%. You know, but it was like, it was crazy. You know, it was anything you wanted at the drop of a hat. You know, you got.
Yeah.
And it was like, that's probably how like rock stars really live or something.
That's it. You get to see how the other half lived, don't you? Like,
oh, yeah, it was pretty crazy.
I could get used to this.
Yeah, and I mean. But it was also really stressful. Like I also like the amount of stress put on those artists to entertain thousands. It's not an easy job, you know. And whether you like those bands or not, that's an admirable skill to have, to entertain the masses. It like there's only a few can do it, you know. And you know, it's just it's crazy to watch. You know, it's special. You know.
You watch a performer like Dave Grohl, and he makes it look so fucking easy. Like, he makes it look, and that's the skill, right? Is obviously it's not. He doesn't just walk on stage without any thought as to what's going to happen. Or maybe he does, I don't know. But he makes it look like a walk in the park. And he makes you feel like you're right there next to him, even if you're a mile away.
Yeah, you do. You know, and I think I think Dave Grohl's pretty cool. You know, and I think that extends, I think, you know, into his like interpersonal relationships as well. A really funny Dave Grohl story is this. Brad, who plays trumpet in the mariachi band and bass in the Bronx, is him and Dave Grohl text each other pictures of barbecuing and smoking and like different meats and cuts and like different woods and all this stuff. I'm just like, it's hilarious. And I keep telling him, I was like, man, no one's ever going to believe you, Brad.
Yeah. Are you guys still in touch with Jorma? And what happened there, if you don't mind me asking?
He just, you know, he needed to do something else, you know, and he joined Eagles of Death Metal, and, you know, he's an incredible drummer, you know, and it's like, I, you know, think he has made that band, you know, amazing. You know, he's a really, really good player. And, you know, it was Dave who plays drums on our fifth record, studio album. We had a band together back in the day with Matt called The Drips.
Right, yeah.
And so it was, we had known him for so long, so it was an easy, you know, he was, had been around our camp forever, so, you know, he played that.
It's a weird kind of world to go into, I think, with everything that happened in fucking Paris and all the backlash to all of that. It must have been quite a, well, and probably still is at times, quite a stressful and fucking difficult situation for him to be in.
It's, I don't know what it, you know, it's hard to put yourself in a situation or understand, like, witnessing, like, a mass execution, like, And
that's what it was. There's no two ways around it.
That's exactly what it was. And, you know, I don't care who you are. That's going to change you, you know, and probably not for the better, you know. And that's, you know, something that we all hope, you know. I mean, and it's so crazy. Like, every concert now is just, like, in America, it's like they go through our gear when we load in. You know, there's metal detectors for the bands that are playing. Like, it's crazy the amount of security that happens at concerts, you know. And, you know, it's where we came from versus where it is now is, like,
unrecognizable in many ways,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's, like, the spirit of it has just been sucked out, you know. And it's, like, I still love playing concerts and going to them and enjoying music, but the unpredictability, the rawness is completely gone. You know, there's no danger. Not that that's a good thing, you know, but this.
Well, yeah, you want a bit. Obviously, you don't want anything like what happened out there in France, but you do want that element of excitement and visceral.
Yeah. Yeah. Rock and roll was exciting, you know, and it was dangerous, you know, and it's just not really anymore. And I mean, not that that's a bad thing, you know, it's like, I don't want to get fucking shot, you know? Yeah. And the fact that that's entered into music, which is the most harmless thing in the world, you know, was a real, real shock to everyone, you know, that plays music and, you know, listens to it or likes to go to concerts. It's like, you know, what's crazy is, my wife's cousin's wife, is that right? Was going to go to that 91, festival in Vegas where the shooting happened, and she got sick, so they didn't go. She also works, there was just another mass shooting at a bar in the Valley. I can't remember the name of it, but she was like, she worked there, and she got sick that night and didn't go to work, and like, just, you know, I think 13 people got shot. And I was just, I was like, we live in a fucking world where, like, she avoided two mass shootings in 1 year. Like, think about that. That just, like, blows my mind, you know? And it's just like, God, what a horrible world, you know?
How do you feel at the moment as an American traveling? Do you feel like there's kind of negative press and attention on your country with the man with the orange face? Not to go too political with you. Because I when the Brexit news went through, and I was like, oh my God, we voted that through. And I found a slight, subtle change in people's behavior and attitude towards me in certain places around Europe when I went. And I can understand it, because they're like, well, you don't want to be a part of this. So you're obviously going to then
feel
like an outsider, aren't you?
I think there's people that, you know what's crazy is the gnarliest I was ever treated was during the Bush administration.
Right.
And, you know, I would get into physical, like, arguments with people. I'm like, you know, just because, you know, he's the president doesn't mean I voted for him, you know? And so it's kind of, if you think about the type of person who's going to give you shit about, you know, someone that's in charge, they don't really understand the you know, political system in America, you know, that you vote people in, and that just, you know, not everyone's the same. And, you know, the thing that I've noticed, and the what I've gotten out of all of this, is that the media is just insane and takes things and spins them for an angle on both sides, the right and the left.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's the thing that I think is really frustrating about it all, is because you're never going to get a straight answer from people that are, their job is to give you a straight answer. You know, I took a journalism course once, and the first rule of journalism is to provide an unbiased, you know, story of a situation.
Yeah.
And that's the last thing you're ever going to find. And so, you know, I think the whole thing,
it's just fear as well, isn't it? It's fear and distraction and, well, trying to divide, and
it is, you know, and it's and all it's really done is just turn people off.
Yeah.
And so many Americans just don't even bother with politics anymore. Like, it's just, it's not worth their time, you know, and there's crusaders for this and crusaders for that. But it feels like it's really died down, because so many people are just deleting their Facebooks and the news sources. They're just not even watching it anymore. And whether that's good or bad, I don't really know, but it's just kind of like the way things are. People are just tired of it, you know, being berated with stuff. And, you know, there's two types of people, you know, there's crusaders and there's people that respect each other's opinions, you know. And, you know, I haven't really run into anybody even really asking me about it over here, you know, or having an opinion, you know.
Yeah.
I think people are getting worn out.
I think as well, at the moment, you're almost not allowed. Well, it's not that you're not allowed, but if you express your opinion, especially on the internet, like, it's different if you're having a conversation like this, because people have taken the time to get 45 minutes into this chat and they've got the context. They're not just seeing a headline. But I do feel like if you express your opinion on anything online and somebody doesn't agree with it, they'll shout in your face and tell you why you're not allowed that opinion, because it's just different to theirs. And you're like, well, when did we get to this? Like, that's fascism to me.
Yeah, like, exactly. You know, and just, you know, throttle jockeys, you know, and people that, you know, I heard a quote one time, and I think it's so pertains to what you just said is like, and to the internet or the media, you know, it's like the internet's greatest strength by connecting all of these people and ideas is also its greatest weakness.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so,
what do you do with your kids? Do you allow them sort of free reign, limited access? What's your approach to parenting when it comes to social media and smartphones and all of that? Because I guess nowadays kids at such a young age have them, and it's the norm that, yeah, I imagine they're probably made to feel left out if they don't, and like unpopular.
100%, 100%. You know, I think that in parenting, the best thing you can do is lead by example, you know, and that's how kids learn. My daughter has, and I hope she doesn't listen to this, you know, kids communicate through Instagram.
Yeah.
It's just how they do it. And I have her Instagram account on my phone, and I go through it, you know, just half of it, or the most part, is to protect her from things that might possibly enter her life through something like that. But, you know, it's the world we live in, you know. It's like, it was probably, you know, like television for me, you know, when I was a kid, you know, it's like
corrupting the youth.
It is, yeah. You know, and it did, yeah. You know, but, you know, I think, you know, there's certain things that are just the way they are in the world. And this is one of them, you know, and, you know, I try to teach my kids to use the internet in a positive way, like as a tool, you know. It's like, anything that you want to know how to do, you can look it up on YouTube, and there'll be an instructional video on, you know, how to mow your lawn, you know. And, you know, I sound like a curmudgeon when I'm just like, if I wanted to learn something, I had to go to the library and check out a book,
you know? Dinosaur.
Yeah. And so
you feel like it can be a positive influence if dealt with.
Well, if they use it as a tool, you know, to further their education, absolutely, you know. But does that happen? Well, you know, they like to watch YouTube videos of people playing video games or something, you know, and I'm like...
Isn't it wild that kids don't really... I mean, I don't really have interaction with kids because I don't have any, but I'm aware of the fact that they don't really text anymore. Even texting is like an outdated
thing. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Well, yeah, it is. It is. It blows my mind, and I don't really...
And like the idea of a phone call... is probably just, you know, they don't do it, do they? Kids don't phone each other up anymore.
No.
What I loved about being young, and I guess I didn't love it at the time, but I like the idea of when you had to call a girl that you likes home phone before mobiles, knowing their parent was probably going to answer, and you had to man up and be like, yeah, it's Matt from school, there's so-and-so there. That's character building, that kind of stuff, isn't it?
It was terrifying, yes. And then, you know, now contacting people is pretty easy, you know, and... Yeah, it is. I mean, I could sit here and reminisce about all the, you know, but it's funny because, you know, I come from a family, you know, it's like, yeah, my dad used to have to walk uphill both ways in the snow to school, you know, like that kind of thing. And I'm the same way, you know. I'm just like, oh man, I need to look up, you know, a book or do this and that. It's like, shut up.
I imagine you have to sound check pretty soon. Before you go, can we talk about the most recent record and just how fucking rock and roll it is? The rock and roll's always been there with the Bronx.
Yes.
But it's very much come to the forefront with this one. I love it for that reason. What was the, I guess, inspiration going in with this album? What did you want to
lay down? We wanted to make a guitar record. And so we did it with this guy who I've known for years. His name is Rob Schnaff. And he produced... everything. Just, I mean, if you Google him, but he has like the collection of guitars and amps. And so every track on that record, we used a different, you know, amp and guitar or pedals and different chains. I think Ken wrote it down. It was like I don't know, 4 pages of handwritten notes on this track, just what we used, you know. And you know, it's hard. And I'm trying not to sound like a hippie, but you just go with what feels right. You know what I mean? And it's like, I know that that's a pretty loose sort of thing, but it's, you know, when we all
trust
get together.
Instincts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When we all get together and we're putting songs together, you know, it's like, you know, you follow your nose, you know, and that's where it wanted to go, you know. And in art, whether it's music, painting, cooking, whatever, if you fight what's coming out, it's crap, you know. And it's like, once art kind of dictates where you need to go, like that to me is where I always try to be. And it, that sometimes that comes out in a mariachi record.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes that comes out in a surf record, you know, and it's just, it kind of, you know, I think we had an idea where we wanted to go, but it also kind of turned into its own thing once we kind of started making it. So,
and the response to the new songs live is phenomenal. Like, they seem to go over as well as, like, you know, songs you've been playing for 10 years.
Yeah. I mean, it's whenever.
'Cause you're playing quite a few new ones, aren't you? You're doing 3, 4?
Depends on the night. I think 4 new ones. It's always, whenever we put out a record, it's always, you know, new songs go over like new songs, and it's always encouraging when you see people singing along early on into the record's career, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And because, you know, it doesn't always do that.
Well, I spoke to Jake a while back, and we were talking about which our favorite Bronx record was, and we were both saying at the time, this is before 5 had come out, but we were both saying 4.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of our friends are like, you're mad. What? Can't be 4. I was like, well, why not?
Want to wrestle?
What's next? Is it going to be back on the mariachi flip next year?
You know.
Or are you just getting this tour done and looking forward to some time off?
Well, yeah, right. We're making a new Bronx record.
Right on.
And, you know, January and February, we're going to kind of start digging in and getting songs together. And then, yeah, I know there's all these rules about announcing tours or something, like you're not supposed to say, and I don't even know, but we have, you know, a year's pretty full.
Right on. Watch this space.
Exactly.
And Pounded by Surf.
Yes.
Any more plans to do anything more with that? I love that stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's just, for me, that kind of, I mean, Tarantino nailed it with the Pulp Fiction soundtrack.
Yeah.
And he made surf music fresh again to a whole new generation of people that would have probably never heard Link Wray, Dick Dale, any of that stuff.
It, you know, that again was following your nose, and it was kind of something that we wanted to do. And like, we got really into surf music, and like within that genre, you know, which is an incredibly small genre, there is, you know, like if you were looking at a pie chart, like a small sliver of kind of this like Western inspired.
Yep.
You know, reverbed out stuff, and we got really into that, and you know, so we, you know, like the whole thing with that was, and that I really got, you know,
that's it, you, Brad, and Dave, right? Is it you, Brad, and Dave?
Dave played drums on the recording, but Vince, who plays guitarón in the mariachi band, plays drums.
Right.
Who's Dave's
and
brother.
Their brothers?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
it's
and their dad's in what legendary band is here?
Los Lobos.
Yes.
Yes. It's all pretty, you know, intertwined.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, you know, to compliment all of these guys that play in all three of these bands, like they're all really good at multiple instruments. You know, I play guitar in most of them, but, you know, but they all, like, you know, somebody's a great drummer as well as a, you know, fill in the blank, or, you know, a great trumpet player or whatever, you know. And so it's pretty easy because we're all together all the time to kind of put bands together, you know. But that one was really, I got obsessed with the idea, not obsessed, but like the challenge of taking the listener, this is going to sound so weird, taking a listener someplace, painting a picture without words telling them where to go or what to do. And it was, you know, all of that stuff, it's like watching the movies to me, you know.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
when
yeah.
I hear it, you know, and it transports you to like whatever scene you want, you know, in the desert, you know,
desert highway. Yeah. Yeah,
somebody asked me what that band sounded like, and I said it sounds like the Doshin. I'm like, well, what's that? That's where the desert meets the ocean.
There you go, hands pounded by the surf.
Exactly.
Love it. Thanks for a great chat, JB.
Yeah, thanks for your time,
man. And thanks for just always being cool, and I like being around you guys. I like watching not just you play, but you're clearly one big happy family without being cheesy.
We are.
And
you know,
I take inspiration from that. Like, you seem to thrive off each other's company on and off the stage, and it's a nice thing to be around.
I was said this the other day. I was like, you know, I've probably had more meals with these 5 people than I have with like my family.
Yeah. <know? laughs> And you still love each other.
Yeah, we do. We get along well. I mean, we play music, you know, I mean, that's pretty cool.